Hello, I am Paige Albiniak, Editorial Director of Promax BDA, and this is the Daily Brief Podcast. You can subscribe to the Daily Brief Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you are enjoying us, please head over to Apple Podcasts, give us all the stars. This helps other people find us. So today I am honored to be joined by Sue Weiss and Joe Tamanini of Studio City. Hi, guys. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Paige. How are you?
Hello. I'm good. How are you?
Great.
Let's kick it off by you guys just telling me and our listeners what Studio City is. I know it's more than a suburb of Los Angeles, but just give me a little rundown of what you guys do and what you both of you do there.
Great. Well, I'll turn it over to the founder, Stuart.
Well, and then he'll fill in, I guess. So Studio City started 23 and a half years ago. We're going to be going into our 25th year, unbelievably, in January. And it started, and I thought, well, you know, we'll give this thing a shot. And I figured, you know, it'll go 2 years, and then I'll go back to the job I had at NBC. But surprise, here we are going into looking at our 25th year. We are predominantly a marketing company. We got our start with, of course, NBC and doing network promos, and then we added to the roster daily topical promos in the syndication market. We got a call from CBS and asking us if we wanted to do these promos for a judge show that they had, and we had not done syndication before. We had spent the first 7 years in business doing network programming, and it's like, yeah, sure, we'd love to give that a shot. And that judge show happened to be Judge Judy. They liked what we did with Judge Judy, and then they had this new talk show with this doctor from Texas. They were unsure how to position, and then along comes Dr. Phil. So we're now having Judge Judy and Dr. Phil in here, and then came Entertainment Tonight. So we kept building all these syndication brands. We had built a machine here, which is not to say a factory, because we're certainly not that, but there is a machine in place here, the infrastructure, that is now, you know, handling about 9,000 promos a year for some of the biggest brands and brands in television, Ellen and Wendy and Dr. Oz. Got a live with Kelly and Ryan. By the way, she's extraordinarily cool. The talk for CBS, Judge Judy's second court show, Hot Bench, and the Steve Harvey Show, now called Steve, and we just added on last year. We're so honored to now have added on Family Feud. And so that's what we've done on the promo side of thing, and then of course we you know, like any good company should, you know, McDonald's used to just sell hamburgers. We decided to diversify, and the diversification effort has really paid off, right, Joe?
Yeah, for sure. I think we've, you know, really done a great effort to not only diversify the client base in the marketing side, but also in original content development. When it comes to, you know, developing formats for networks as well as original shows, we just over the last couple of weeks completed a pilot for DIY Network, which aired I want to say 3 weeks ago at this point, where we found talent, wrote, edit, produced, shot, filmed, did the whole thing, you know, throughout the, of course, winter in the Catskills. Why not? We're able to get that all the air, and our efforts continue to move. Run parallel in that direction along with the marketing front, because in this day and age, you need to be a content creator as much as a marketer of said content.
Let's talk a little bit about the syndicated side, and then we'll talk about the original programming side and some of the other things that you do. But
sure.
On the syndicated side, and from what I see, I think cutting promos for these day and date syndicated shows is a very specific art in this day and age, because it's one of the few areas of television where you still are in that business of just tonnage and frequency, and it's just lots and lots of spots. So how have you honed this process for greatest efficiency for you and for your clients?
You know, like Stu said, you know, there is a high volume of that work to be done. We're fortunate in that what we get to do on a daily basis is to evolve a brand literally daily. So if we are looking at market trends and ratings reports, we can adapt immediately. We don't have to wring our hands for an entire week with those spots, you know, trying to figure out what our next play is. So that's a huge point. I think what we've really been able to do is be able to, first and foremost, establish trust with our client base. We don't have time in that daily turnaround for, you know, three and four sets of notes going up and down the chain. You know, it takes a while to get there with a new account. And once we have that trust, we protect it like it's our child, because, you know, we need to be able to work efficiently and be able to turn on a dime in those moments. So that's first and foremost. And then, you know, we've taken the tack where, you know, our creative directors on each show really own that brand. Each and every brand, and they're the final arbiters, frankly. And in some cases, you know, even our clients, even the studio clients, are deferring to our creative directors as a liaison to the show, because they're just so tapped into it. So to be able to develop those relationships, then on top of the efficiencies that we've created in the production workflow, I think have been a huge advantage. We won't give away the secret recipe so much when it comes to the, but we really have, we developed, a great team of people who, they don't take things personally, and we just got to get things done. And that's really been our motto.
You know, we handle eight different shows here. It goes without saying that some of them are going to compete head to head, you know, to speak to what you were saying, Paige. This is an area of the industry that very few people have invested in. We have heavily invested in it, so much so that we're even working with the Daytime Emmy Award people, because we're just so invested in the daytime viewer and the daytime audience and our daytime brands. And with that comes the responsibility of obviously keeping things secret from one another. And, you know, you got a lot of markets where some of our brands are going head-to-head. We've got in one market at one particular hour where three of our shows are competing with each other, and we want each one of them to compete favorably in the genre that they represent. And we try not to cross over too much. We have the one court show that we're very, very proud of. We have the one entertainment show that goes after a specific viewer, and another entertainment show that goes after another specific viewer. And then we have one that's kind of in the crime drama medical genre, which of course is Dr. Oz, who's expanded his brand. So we're very, very protective of all these brands to make sure that they perform individually, even though they compete against each other sometimes.
Right. Do you think staying in this world of syndication was just something that's happened for you because you got in early on Judge Judy and Dr. Phil, and I mean Live, Ellen, all those shows probably, you know, they're among the top of syndication. So it's for you guys, it's steady work, but I would say it's not an easy business to get into at this point, because there's not a lot of new shows coming in. There's not a lot of turnover, all that kind of thing.
Well, you're absolutely right. You know, a lot of the clients that we have been with us for over a decade. Ellen has been here for about 12 years. And of course, the talk is going, we're going into our 10th year there. Same with Wendy. So we've been with these brands for, you know, almost a decade or sometimes more. So there's been that trust factor there. But we certainly did not come to the table early. Syndication has been around since the 60s. And we, of course, were not around then, and I don't know if anybody in this telephone call was.
But certainly not.
We don't want to say that. But syndication has been around a very, very long time and has evolved for a very long time. We got into the syndication business only in the early 2000s. So the business had been already robust for 40 years before we entered it. Unfortunately, what had happened was I think a lot of the people who were in the syndication marketplace before did not grow. They were treating daytime shows like daytime shows, and they looked like it, and they felt like it. Some of them were all using the same voiceover announcer, and they all sounded and looked like daytime syndication shows. And they just kind of had this worn-out look and feel, and it was kind of, it felt like it was produced in a factory. And so, you know, being that I myself personally spent a lot of time doing primetime marketing for NBC, I believe we brought a primetime feel to all the shows we have. Just because a show airs in daytime does not mean it doesn't deserve a primetime feel. So that's why the graphics do look as good as they do, and the sound does sound as good as it does. And the editors that we have on, you know, who are editing these spots, you know, all come from Trailer World. They come from primetime, come from Netflix, what have you. And so they're all bringing that feel to an audience that deserves that kind of quality.
And in looking at the numbers, there are, you know, there's days that our top, you know, some of our top shows are outperforming primetime, you know, on the exact same network in some markets.
Right.
So that's always an interesting thing to look at. So, yeah, it's a tough formula to crack, certainly. And if one doesn't have the infrastructure behind it, you know, when it comes to the capabilities and technical capabilities to be able to, you know, turn on that dime, you know, so to speak, when there's guest dropouts and all these other types of things. Yeah, it is a challenge. I know that, you know, we're very fortunate to have these accounts, and I know they're accounts that are very coveted. But I think when, you know, people start to look at the actual logistics behind them, their heads start to spin. And fortunately, we've been able to solve that Rubik's Cube a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think you bring up a good point, too, about syndication, which is considering the market in which daytime shows or even access or late night, wherever it's whatever time slots those shows are in. But I mean, in order to compete, because now you're competing against everything on cable and everything on streaming, you do have to play at a higher level. And it's hard because, you know, if TV stations are paying that bill, I think they're trying to cut costs. It's just a very difficult and challenging marketplace.
Sure.
Let's talk about the Daytime Emmys for a second. So Daytime Emmys this year, I think it was the 45th. They took place at the Pasadena Civic Center, I believe, or Civic Auditorium last weekend. They, for the past couple of years, they haven't been on television. This year, they were live streamed across several platforms. What did you guys do for the Daytime Emmys? What was your involvement?
Well, it's an honor to be part of the Daytime Emmy Award community. These people are so hardworking, and they're so dedicated, and you can see the passion that people who work for the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences truly, truly care about each one of the brands that they too represent, that there's a true love and passion there for them. And for us, they needed some help because, as you had mentioned, they have been off broadcast for a while. They're still searching for a new home. We believe that they'll come back again to at least to the cable space, but because they have not been able to be exhibited on a cable network or a broadcast network, of course their budgets have been compromised, and we didn't want their product to suffer as a result of it. So we came in and did pretty much took over the design of the 44th and 45th Emmy Awards. We've done their graphic design, their look, their brand, the logos that you see on the stage, the logo that you see in the ticket that you get, you know, the folks who attended the award, the water bottles that were out being handed to people. We made sure that the brand was consistent everywhere. And we, of course, did those packages that, you know, you always watch these award shows, and there they are, the celebrities are standing from the stage about to announce the nominees, and they go, the nominees are, and then up rolls the package where they show clips from the five nominees, and you wonder, who did those? You know, who did that clip where they say the name of the star, they show the little clip, sound up, and then go on to the next star and sound up and transition, what have you. You always wonder who does those packages and those award shows. Well, this year was us. And that's kind of like a childhood dream that I personally have had. I've always wanted to do that. And so there were 24 categories. Three, by the way, were Spanish language categories, so that was a bit of a challenge. But there were 24 packages, and in a three-hour broadcast, we probably had an hour of when you count the In Memoriam package, we probably had an hour of content in that 3 hours.
I think that until I did this job, it actually never occurred to me who cut those packages. But I mean, I think if you're a viewer, you just assume the network is doing it. I don't think you really think about it. But yeah, now that I do this job, I do think about those things. Who cut that package? How did that come to? How did this happen? How did this manifest? So, I mean, I think the other thing that's a little interesting about that is all the branding work that you did that has much of which has nothing to do with broadcast or streaming. It has to do with invitations or water bottles or signage. You know, there's a lot of things that go on there that people just, I think, kind of take for granted because it's in front of them.
Sure. I was so surprised at how many places that brand shows up on the step and repeat on the red carpet. You know, there's your logo up there, you know, multiplied 100 times in the background. So, yeah, and when, you know, you see it on the ticket and you see it on the envelope that's holding the ticket, it's just mind-boggling. And one of the things that we wanted to be cautious of, because I've watched certainly a lot of award shows in my time, you know, sometimes you'll see these packages, whether it be the Oscars or the Golden Globes or the Primetime Emmy Awards, you know, the package will play and they'll show a clip. Then when they cut to the audience member which that clip was featured, say it's like Meryl Streep, which of course is not a Daytime Emmy contender, but she's sitting in the audience and you just got done showing a clip, and then they cut to Meryl Streep, and sometimes, you know, you get a sour reaction from the artist who's sitting in the audience going, who cut that? And I think that for me was driving a lot of our creative. We certainly didn't want to have our package end, and then they cut to the featured talent, and then they have a sour look on their face, you know, with the unfortunate, ooh, who cut that package look? So that was our divining rod. Do people use divining rods anymore, by the way?
I don't think so.
I have no idea. One other thing is, see, I mean, in general, you guys have a lot coming up right now because you've got all the day and date stuff you just mentioned. You just got done with the daytime Emmys. The upfronts, have been going on for a while, but the main upfronts, the network upfronts, come up in 2 weeks. And then you have ProMax BDA. We have Station Summit at the end of June, and I know you guys are putting together packages for that as well. So right now, what is your priority and what is taking up most of your time?
All of it. I mean, yeah, it's been a little bit of, you know, just trying to make sure that all the planes land safely, you know, on the aircraft carrier here, so to speak. But yeah, up front, certainly, because that's the, you know, staring us right in the face. We've been doing that work. And, you know, and then we're, you know, I think in the beginning stages or middle stages of work that's going to be seen then at the Station Summit. So it's just a matter of just kind of maintaining, you know, that creative and making sure that things are falling into place, you know, in that regard. And then, you know, really just, and then of course, yes, like with the day and date stuff, pushing ahead to Memorial Day, which, you know, we end up having to, like, frankly, double produce material because you need to advance ship a lot of material. So because people are off that Monday, and frankly, that's kind of when summer starts. So, you know, we've been, you know, in contact with all the studios, we've been in contact with all the stations, and they've, you know, given us their wish list as they do every year as to when they want things delivered. So it's really been, you know, all hands on deck, you know, and then atop that, prepping for, you know, another conference that we go to, that being Real Screen, where we go to showcase our, you know, like we mentioned, original content before. So we're in the process of shooting sizzles and getting formats together. You know, so we've really been kind of going like gangbusters over here. So I'm surprised we're even this articulate in the moment.
Yeah, and then the other thing is May Sweeps, which is now.
Right. And Frank, you know, interestingly, so yes, May Sweeps is now. And of course, the day and date stuff that we've been doing has been, you know, eating up a lot of that effort and time. Our May Sweeps work really hits mid-April, in that that's when we're delivering a lot of the, you know, new month generics. And here's what's coming up in May pieces, as well as contest spots. So thankfully, the majority of that wave's already over, and so now it's now our daily show teams can really dig into the daily creative of sweeps. Now that these, you know, contests and radio pieces are kind of out of the way, et cetera. So yeah, it's been yes, a lot.
if just like a technical 101 question, but let's say it's April, because I just did lots of syndication rating stories. It's April and Dr. Phil is in repeats for the most part. Are you guys still cutting new promos for that, or do they use promos from before when they aired the episode previously, or how does that work?
So when we cut a package for an all-new episode that then turns into a rerun, we just strip the all-new branding off of it, and it's just quickly a retag that's okay. Kind of sent out for rerun. And then, of course, when we do know when a show is on a little bit of a, you know, mid-spring hiatus, then, of course, we ramp up, you know, with the messaging of is back and all new, you know, which sounds so basic. It really does. It sounds like the most basic thing that you can put in a script, but you can't say it loud enough in order to, you know, get people's attention, you know, that might have kind of drifted a little bit, you know, in the viewership. So,
Who writes syndication ratings every week, you definitely see when shows are in all new episodes, and particularly Ellen and Wendy, they get a huge bump when they're all new versus when they're in repeat. So it makes a difference.
You're absolutely right. And those two brands that you identified, those two shows in particular, are their viewers are so into it, like so into it.
Yeah.
They so know. And in fact, when there's, you know, a little bit too much of a hiatus, they're not shy about, you know, voicing those things, you know, on social channels and whatnot. So then, of course, we take a look at all of that, and then we try to really lean into what they feel that they've been missing during that hiatus. So whether it's, you know, eventizing the return a little bit, you know, or, you know, kind of maybe leaning into some of the A-list talent that an Ellen's going to get for, you know, for a May sweep period. It totally depends, of course, you know, per brand. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we see Wendy stick around through July, because it keeps her ratings up. Yeah, so it definitely makes a difference.
It used to be, I mean, and it's really changed the business model a little bit also, because, you know, at one point we were able to give our staff, who's been working really, really hard. I mean, you know, unlike a lot of, and this is not to take away from any of our peers, so please do not look into this as an insult by any means, because I came there, but, you know, each one of our brands have 200 plus episodes. In the case of Ellen's, about 195. In the case of Live, they never have a rerun. It's called Live. So there's 260 episodes. And so the business model's changed a little bit, that a lot of the shows that are on for maybe 200, 220 episodes, they now scatter them through the summer. That never happened before. They would normally end at the Memorial Day weekend. They'd take off June, July, and August, and then we'll see in September. But it has been, in a lot of cases, so difficult to then relaunch in September that the shows have decided, you know what, we're going to put new episodes in through the summer. So, you know, for the folks here at Studio City, we just never get a break.
Yeah.
Right.
I know. None of us really ever get a break, but we won't complain about that. But I'm going to go back to upfronts for 1 second, which is, what about upfronts do you love and what about upfronts do you hate?
Loaded question.
Well, you know,
such a loaded question to talk about in such a coded manner.
I think, you know, this is one of those things where you want to invest your heart and soul into something and be a realist at the same time. And also knowing, you know, what the stakes are. It's a little bit of a gamble, too, that you're playing with your emotions. You know, there are some networks that are in a position where, you know, they don't need a lot of shows to launch their new season. They probably only have, like, maybe three or four spots. So the chances that your upfront presentation will actually get to the finish line is maybe a little more in doubt than, say, a network that has to replace, I don't know, you know, 12 bus spots. It's such an emotional roller coaster that you're going through, because a lot of networks will double vend. You know, we're getting some work, and the folks at Ant Farm are getting some work, and Trailer Park are getting some work. And so sometimes you're competing against, you know, your friends at those places. And of course, you want to win that bake-off, that competition. You want to be the one that goes to the upfront. So it is. It's very emotional for both the client side and for our side, because we're in competition and the networks are in competition, and you know, nobody's getting sleep during these days. They're up all night long nursing their babies to the finish line, and you know, they too get invested and on the marketing side. A lot of these the marketing departments and the networks get, you know, they have their favorites, and then when the programming department comes in and says, you know, we're going to kill that one, they're devastated. So it's a slug, a truly emotional slug during these 3 weeks leading up to upfronts.
And I'd also say, to add on to some of that, I think the interesting thing about upfronts is it's a unique thing for an agency where you now have to look through 3 to 4 brand lenses in order to create an upfront trailer, right? So you have a brand new show that no one's seen before, so now you want to get yourself invested in it, right? So you want to, you know, really speak to what that story is. Then you need to look at the brand lens of what the network is as a whole and how it fits into their roster and the people that are making the decisions, right? Well, on the client end. Then you got to look through the brand voice of, well, it's the advertisers that are ultimately going to be, you know, leaning into this, right? So right there, you've now given yourself 3 audiences that have distinctly different needs, that, you know, versus doing a general market trailer, you know, for a broad, you know, audience for women 18 to 34, right? Already you're coming at it from 15 different directions. So everything from, you know, music. So like the younger folk, you know, on the staff, they want to go digging into Spotify and find all the young indie groups and whatnot. When, you know, some of these, you know, folks at the network have been there for many, many years, and maybe they're not so hip into that music yet, or even editorial style, et cetera, and really making sure that you're, you know, staying in that. So it's a lot of decoding as much as it is creating.
And, you know, every single soundbite that appears in these pilots that nobody has ever seen before, except the network executives, of course. Every single soundbite, you're second guessing, is that the one that they want in there, or is that the one they don't care about? I mean, you're going through 42 minutes of content that's being put into this 3.5-minute trailer, and hoping that you're making it right, because some network executive, you know, wants that soundbite that appeared in 24.5 minutes, and they think that is the one that pretty much is the signature line of the entire show, and God help you if you didn't include that in the trailer, how could you leave that line out? That's the line. I was like, all right, I don't think so. It's that whole thing too, that guessing game that you're having with the person who's ultimately deciding the fate of the trailer.
It seems like they could just tell you that up front.
This is
the line, cut a trailer around it. Yeah, the upfronts, for agencies, upfronts always seem very fraught to me, just for all those reasons that you talked about, because you don't know what's going to get picked up. It's a ton of work, and you don't really know what's going to be kept or what's going to be thrown out, and you can't know. So on one hand, it's a ton of work, and that's great. On the other hand, it's a ton of work, and it's hard.
The other part for an agency, too, is the stakes involved. You know, we're fortunate to have the relationships that we've had over the 24-plus years going into our 25th year that we do, and that's fantastic. You know, I feel for the boutique agencies that are going out there and trying to get this work, because they're trying to make an impression on the network to say, give us your business, and rightly so, and, you know, pounding down that door. So it's not just the stakes of, is my cut going to get bought? It's what is the impression of my work and the workflow and how we handled the executives while getting the work done, and it just compiles down the line. Where, frankly, the edit starts to fall to the background a little bit, you know, when people are in that position.
And then you mentioned that it's tricky because you're also cutting spots that have to sort of serve a lot of different brand positions. Would you say that has always been true, or is that something that's evolved in the past few years?
I mean, look, Stu could probably speak to a lot of that given his longevity in the game, and I mean that with all sincere love and respect.
He doesn't. No, he doesn't.
I think it's something that's become more and more prevalent given the fact that advertising dollars are now so much harder to come by. The diversification of networks, you know, when it comes to then cable nets, et cetera, for people to be spending the dollars. I think the masters, so to speak, have grown exponentially, you know, over the last several years.
What do you think, Stu?
Well, I can't disagree. And also, I think the networks are also being very, very cautious about being honest to their brand, which is something we've noticed, too. There are shows that we're getting in now that, oh, yeah, that really is a CBS show. That feels and looks, this show does not look like anything that would air on ABC. It's clearly not. And that's an NBC show. This does not look like it would appear on CBS. So, you know, it's not only so much even convincing the advertisers that this is a good show for the network, but also that it belongs there, that it flows, that as they're advertising, say, in NCIS, that it also makes sense that now that ad, you know, can also appear in that bridge between NCIS and whatever this new show might be. So there's a lot of that. It is funny how the shows and the content that we're getting look exactly like who the buyer is.
Yeah, I mean, that could be another podcast, but I do think that these general entertainment networks are having to really land on a brand just for the point, just so they can differentiate themselves in a very crowded marketplace. So, you know, people will still argue that ABC, NBC, CBS don't really have brands, but I'm with you guys. I think that if you're looking, they do have brands, and that's getting more and more clear as they go. Like ABC, I think, just rebranded to, maybe not rebranded, but have been branding themselves America's Network, which I think is somewhat new.
Yeah. In fact, I mean, we just had a meeting with a cable network that's rebranding itself, and we were discussing about who their viewer is and who's on both sides, who's on one side of the camera and who the viewer is. And, you know, there are brands that are proud to be, you know, all male. And is there any female appeal here? Nope, none at all. And they're good with that. Absolutely not. We do not believe in co-viewing. We just want guys between 25 and 54 who live in the Midwest, and that's all we want. It's like, okay. That, of course, helps to find the message. And then there are some brands that are actually a little more right down the line. There's no blending of even the races. There are some brands that are all African-American, and they're perfectly happy being that. And there are some brands that I won't tell you which ones they are, that are completely white, and they are really not in the market. Place to be diversified. So it's really interesting how the brands have defined themselves, and you know, they're all successful in attracting the audiences that they attract.
Okay, so we'll another time I'll have you guys back, and we'll talk a little bit more about branding and all of that. But let's go into, you mentioned at the top that you were in the production business. You just did, I believe, that the show that you just did was for DIY.
Yep. It's called Cabin Wonderlust.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about being in the production business? And besides that show, you guys have done several other shows too, right?
So besides doing the promos that's for air and the promos for digital and the promos for social media, we also, of course, do sizzle reels. And we talked about that. And so we'll be doing a lot of sizzle reels for shows that don't exist yet. And a lot of times we'll be creating sizzle reels for shows that the content doesn't exist. They haven't shot a pilot. They haven't picked the host. We're just doing a concept sizzle reel. And so we've done, lots of those. And over the years, we've had our clients tell us, well, that's a really great sizzle reel. I hope the show is as good as the sizzle reel is. And we've heard that comment many times. And then we've started hearing, well, God, that's a really good sizzle reel for a show that doesn't deserve one. Why don't you guys come up with a show and make your own sizzle reel? And we thought, all right, if you're willing to hear one, sure. And so we developed a couple of sizzle reels, and one was for a TV show that was somewhat unique in that it was a diverse entertainment nightly news show that took place in a radio station. In fact, it took place in four of them. And we shopped that thing around for 3 years, and everybody said, no, we're not really interested, but thanks anyway. And then we got a call from Fox going into a Thanksgiving weekend in 2010. Hey, tell us about this show that you were talking about called Dish Nation. And so I did the pitch on a bus. Going to visit my family in Scranton, and the next year we were on the air. And so Dish Nation's been on the Fox station following TMZ, well, since 2011. So where are we? 7 years. We're going into our 2000th episode. And so once you get a bite of the apple, and once you get a taste of now being on the programming side, you want to produce the next one and the next one and the next one. And that's kind of where it all started.
I think of Dish Nation as the show that forced Stephen Brown to work all night long every night.
See, it was with Stephen Brown. He was our champion. We had never. He took a chance on us, and we're going to be forever grateful for him for that. Here's this promo company that comes up with a show idea, and now all of a sudden we've got 260 episodes a year to crank out. And by the way, it's not just this wasn't just a talk show. This was pretty much a live to tape show where you're getting in feeds from Atlanta and New York. And
right.
Dallas and Detroit, and they're all getting fed in at 6 o'clock in the morning, and you're slicing and dicing 60 hours, literally 60 hours of content to be up on the bird by noon. It was maddening, and he trusted us. Somehow we got it done, and here we are again, 2,000 episodes later, still going.
Just for people's reference, Stephen Brown is I think he's EVP of programming at the Fox television stations. Just so you guys know. So then, in terms of the DIY show, Cabin Wonderlust, what brought that about, and have you guys? I mean, Dish Nation is sort of a specific show. Again, it's very, very day and date. This other show would be, I would assume, many less episodes. Are you moving more into that kind of, lifestyle type of programming?
Well, actually, we're moving into, frankly, the programming that speaks to us as creators. And I know that sounds like a very esoteric,
what you're saying is you would like to go be in a cabin because you're tired.
No, not at all. Not at all. No. So since Dish Nation, hit, we obviously then started getting other calls for what else do you got? And, we've been through several development cycles for anything from the automotive space to lifestyle and moving on. And, we really have started having, some pretty decent success in getting these ideas created. But one thing we agreed to as we, Stu, myself, and several other members of the development team agreed to is that we didn't want to just put out content that was derivative of what already exists. Not that there's anything wrong with that programming, but we're not just going to create another real this in this city here type of show just to do it. We're fortunate that we have the marketing mothership to keep everything going while we can take a little extra time to find what those ideas are. But really, we've got to have a little bit of a passion behind it. And we meet with, other producers who have ideas and want to bring on, ideas on a napkin. And you can very quickly tell when you're listening to their pitch to us whether or not they're invested. And if they're not invested, then we're not going to be invested, right? So, so we've really been a little selective, but we're frankly in all territories. And I think what's great, both from a diversity play, from a gender play, and from a generational standpoint, is that everyone on our development team has different interests. And so we're not going to stop someone from bringing something to life if they really have a belief in it. So we look at what exists already in the marketplace, who the buyers could be, how can we find some, a different entry point into a story, and so on and so forth. So we're over here in crime with some things, we're in historical things, we're in current events, we're in Like I said, automotive, lifestyle, celebrity stuff, format-driven things. It sounds like we're all over the place, and we are, and we love it.
Yeah, well, I think in this day and age, you should be and you can be, so why not be? So
right.
Sort of merging this conversation together, I feel like entertainment promotion, I mean, entertainment in general, it's all changing from the traditional. So in the case of promotion, though, it used to be, I think, much more about a 10-second or 15-second or 30-second spot. You guys still do quite a bit of that. But I also think that whole model is changing. So is that something you're experiencing? And if so, how are you managing that change?
Yeah, I mean, we as a company, you know, you have to recognize where the interests are and where the viewers are. I mean, in 2000, you know, thank you, Donald Trump, for really, really changing, you know, what our eyeballs are watching. We're watching more MSNBC and Fox News than we ever have. And the commentary on what's going on in politics. We're more invested as a country in politics than we've ever been. We're coming up on a midterm election here. That's probably going to break all kinds of records as far as voter turnout for a midterm election. And because our company recognizes that, we're now going into the political space. We've been brand managers for Dr. Oz and Judge Judy and Dr. Phil and Ellen and Tyra Banks and Katie Kirk and Wendy Williams and all these people. Well, we could be brand managers for politicians. And so we've developed now a political wing to the company, and our first candidate is Maxine Waters. Congresswoman Maxine Waters has come to us, and we're helping her with her reelection campaign for 2018. We're working with a congresswoman from Pennsylvania who's hopefully going to be the first female congresswoman in that state in a very long time. There's nobody there's no women in Congress in Pennsylvania. We're working with a woman from Alabama. So we are in marketing, we are in content development, we are now in politics, so we're pretty much all over the map, and we love it, because you know, there is never a dull moment here. I'm here 23 and a half years, and this is, I swear to God, the best year we've ever had. For our editors and for our writers and for our graphic designers and our audio people, they never know what they're going to do next. You know, one day you're working on Maxine Waters, one day you're working with Dr. Oz, one day you're working on you know, a dog show that we're, you know, trying to sell in content development side. So it's pretty exciting to be here.
I thought you were going to say you've been there 23 and a half hours a day. Not you.
No, well, he
probably feels like that also, though.
We've had those.
We've had those.
Yeah, thank you.
If you read our email timestamps, you would agree that might be the case.
What were you going to add anything to that, Joe?
Well, what I was going to add was, so like your initial question about, you know, the kind of living in that 30 and 15 and 20 world that, you know, I think a lot of people are kind of locked into in a more linear sense. That yeah, we need to, with every campaign that we put together and every spot that we do, even the day and date stuff, need to make sure that it's got legs beyond that for social, digital, and have a pass around value. I mean, there's several of our shows, you know, when Instagram and, you know, put the Instagram stories, you know, into play, mm-hmm. and that, you know, started really taking off, then we very quickly started offering, along with our packages, you know, just little short 3 to 5 second vertical, you know, kind of graphics only things, because a lot of people are scrolling stories while they're not supposed to be in a meeting with mute on, right? You know, of kind of, you know, who the guest is, what the topic is of the next day, and getting that to our clients. And then looking at ways for, you know, if we're going to be licensing music, how does that play, you know, if we're going to license a pop song, how does that play in multitudes of lengths across, you know, all formats, so that it really feels like a 360 campaign that's not just sitting as a tagline in an on-air spot. I think the more we get, and I say we not as a company, I say we as creators across this industry, the more that we get to that kind of 360 look at all things, the better and more cohesive those campaigns can be, instead of just kind of being an afterthought in any process. I think what's really been encouraging is seeing and hearing from all of our clients and every studio that we work with, that kind of siloed programming, marketing, digital, all of that stuff that used to be so kind of protected and walled off departmentally, those walls have started to come down. And what's great about that is that then all departments are speaking at the same time into the creation of something, instead of things just being piecemealed together down the line. And when we can be part of that, you know, at the very beginning of those dialogues, which we are 90% of the time with our clients, it's going to make for a far better campaign. And I think it's really great to see that the industry as a whole is adapting in those kinds of ways.
I think that's one of those things where it sounds great to say if it's being accomplished, that's also great. I think it's much harder in practice than in theory. But I also, the other part of it that I think is interesting, and this is true for the whole industry as well as Studio City, which is, you know, the way with all the different platforms and the different ways of getting the word out, everybody's having to become kind of a brand strategist or becoming an analyst. Like, it's not just about, here's some spots we made for you, good luck, run them. You know, it's really sure. about all the strategy behind the brand, which I'm not, you know, people are really having to adapt to. I'm not sure that's necessarily, you know, when they became a promo editor that they thought, oh, I'm going to actually become a brand strategist, but it sort of brought that upon people.
No, it certainly has. And your statement about it, it's hard in some ways and easy in others, and you're absolutely right. I think, you know, where we sit and most agencies sit kind of being on the outside of a larger corporate structure is, you know, it's up to us as the agency to wrangle all of those departments together. As much as
right.
we need to be at their beck and call, we also have to, you know, kind of help bring the entire tent together to say, okay, guys, so we're doing this over here for this department, and then we're also doing over this. How can we just merge all of this together? And it's a unique place to be, you know, on an agency side, to be kind of that independent bystander. You know, it's like when you go to when you go to your friend's house and you're having dinner, and then all of a sudden the whole family starts fighting, and then you're like, okay, cool, I'll just be here for a minute. You know, but you start to absorb a lot of what's going on, and then you're like, oh, great, now let's pull all this back together and enjoy the rest of our day. So we kind of have to do that a little bit, but it kind of comes with the territory, I think.
And then going back to the political stuff real quick, do you feel like when you're working with a candidate, I know this is sort of new, but do you feel like branding is branding and or media is media, or that it's a different approach when you're working with candidates and political?
I hate to say this, but the because we don't want our competitors to get the same idea we did to go to this area, but there's really only about six companies that are doing all the political ads that you see in all the markets, which is kind of silly. And that's why you see political ad running in Colorado looks the same as the one that runs in Georgia.
Right.
I mean, it
right.
just shouldn't be. So we're happy to be in that space. But believe it or not, it's not a huge leap. The one candidate we're talking about needs a spot that focuses on education. Well, okay, a show might want to focus on one particular member of the cast, because all of our candidates that we're working with have multiple dimensions to them, and they have multiple assets that need to be hit to different constituencies. You know, they may represent a district, for instance, where education is important to one group over here, housing is important to another group over here, and Medicare is important to another group over here. And millennials, by the way, a whole different message, needs to be brought to them. So there's strategies, and thankfully, with Facebook having the technology to be able to sector off these very, very specific demographics. I just want to hit women in Torrance between the ages of 25 and 35, making, 100,000 to 150,000 a year. You know, you can do that and have messages that are specific. So I have to tell you, and I all of our competitors, close your ears. It's probably a lot easier to do political advertising because it is so niche and you're going after such a specific consumer versus what we do on the broadcast side, where you're going after a vast number of people. That promo that plays in New York has to also appeal to that individual that lives in Tupelo.
Right. I think in the end, though, what the real skill that you have is you're always telling a concise story in a specific amount of time. So whether that a candidate in Detroit wants to talk about water quality, I'm making this up, or NBC wants to promote its new primetime drama. Either way, you're still having to tell a story so that people get it and get it quickly.
And it's got to emotionally connect, and it's got to connect. You can't talk above the audience. I mean, and I think that's one of the great successes that we've honed and really, really drilled down here, that every single message that comes out of here, whether it's a 5 or a 30 or a 90 or a 2 minute, that there is an emotional connection that we make with everybody who consumes the products that come out of here. And if we haven't done that, then we have not done our job. But connectivity is probably the most important. If I'm going to give away any secret sauce that we do here, it's that.
But don't you think that, storytelling, connecting emotionally, the industry has changed quite a bit, but those things have always remained true.
It is absolutely true. And we are sometimes surprised at how many people fail to you know, put that in their spots. It's kind of like, you know, you're talking at the audience, not with them. There's a lot of spots and not all of them, you know, hit the mark. John Miller, when at NBC, you know, taught me that every spot needs to have somebody, a rooting interest. You have to have somebody in that spot that you root for. I thought that was a really, really good message. That was a great lesson I learned from him. But I think sometimes we fail to recognize, you know, think of who that viewer is that you're talking to, whether it is a voter or a viewer, and what is the message you want to communicate to that person? If you really thought about it, you'd be changing the copy a little more. You'd be adding a little more humanity to, I think, your words when you're realizing you try to, in your head, personify what that individual looks like.
Right. Joe, would you add anything to that?
Look, at the end of the day, you know, the connectivity is key, and I think we've seen that trend certainly resonate, you know, across the last at least 10, 12 years where, you know, we've just look at the way VO is handled in a spot, right? I mean, 15 years ago, it was let's get the biggest boomy voice and let's make it sound big and important and everything else. And now it's frankly, let's find the most conversational voice and be able to, you know, of course, then, you know, craft the words that can go with it. And I think that trend has really paid off, because then instead of it sounding like exactly what Stu said, being spoken at, you're being spoken to and spoken with as a viewer. And I think, you know, that's really where, you know, everybody's, you know, been really great to adapt. I think that's also why, you know, the social channels have been so successful and stars can pop up, because literally someone is sitting in their bedroom talking to you and not at you. And that's, I think, the success of some of these things.
Yeah, I agree. All right. There's a lot of places there where we could have spun off and done whole other episodes, but in the interest of time, I'm going to wrap it up here. Thank you guys, both of you. And I hope you make it through these next couple months intact and come out for vacation or something in July or August.
We sure will.
And invite us back when we had more sleep.
I don't know what your sleep schedule is, but yeah, you're welcome back anytime. And then if I don't see you, hopefully I'll see you at Station Summit. Thanks, both of you. We will talk again soon.
Thank you for having us. This has been an honor to join with you today. Thank you so much for having us.
Paige Albiniak is editorial director of Promax BDA. Kareem Taylor produced this episode. Video Helper provided the music. Digital producer Kate Lekier-Marion contributes to Daily Brief. Follow Promax BDA on Twitter, Facebook, and other social media platforms at Promax BDA. You can reach out to us at dailybrief@promaxbda.org, and you can subscribe to the Daily Brief podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.